Let's go on and consider how it is once we have set this up, once we have our variable sets to create a possible world, and then once we have our constraints to characterize the kinds of possible worlds we're looking for, then what? Or, in other words, what are the algorithms we bring to play on these data structures? And these data structures are kind of tricky. You know, I say data structures here, but as you're finding out, as you work on your second programming assignment, it's a little tricky to say these things are data structures, because they're not obviously queues or stacks or sets or anything like that. So you have to do a little work. So now we need to figure out how it is we manipulate these things, and essentially the answer is... So this is the reasoning procedure in general, and that's essentially assign values to variables to satisfy constraints. That's what we need algorithms to do. And we're actually going to have a lot of algorithms that do this, but they also manipulate the data structures too, because this is an example of a technique that requires a lot of massaging to get it to go through. Now, there are a number of objectives to doing this. I will go from most general to least general. The first question you might want to ask is there a solution? In other words, is there a model for your problem that you set up? Notice that this is a yes-no answer. The next highest level is, what is the solution? Again, a model. And this is what we're going to be interested in. We're going to be interested in algorithms that help answer this question. And then, of course, we can, what are all the models? How many models are there? What's the best model for some definition of best, whatever you consider best to be? And the most general case is, characterize the structure of models. In other words, given a set of models, what can you say about the nature of a solution to this problem? Is there something you can observe? Like, for example, is it always the case that if you're going to solve this problem, the temperature has to be greater than 40 degrees Fahrenheit? Can you observe that from the set of models that you find for a particular problem? This is actually an advanced problem. This is something that you'll deal with in artificial intelligence, as opposed to this class, but that's sort of the most general approach that you can take. Some of the algorithms that we will look at have an interesting property, so I'll talk a little bit about that. Some algorithms can't find a solution, and that allows you to conclude that solutions don't exist. This problem cannot be solved. In fact, the first algorithm that we're going to look at is an example of that kind of algorithm. On the other hand, there are other algorithms which, if they don't find a solution, does not necessarily let you conclude that there are no solutions. And these are some of the algorithms that we'll be looking at next in Thursday and again next Tuesday. So this is important because we're going to combine these algorithms in some cases. So it's important to understand when an algorithm fails, what that means, whether you can use that piece of information to do something further, as would be the case for the first kinds of algorithms, or whether that's not a particularly important or useful piece of information, as in the case of the second kinds of algorithms. The final thing I'd like to say is that the nature of constraint satisfaction problems is economically important, which essentially means that there are lots of companies that have huge constraint satisfaction problems that they need to have solved, and they're willing to spend millions of dollars to spend them. An obvious example is this illustrious institution. What's a constraint satisfaction problem that's really important to dear old MU? Classroom assignment. You have a bunch of classrooms that are available at the beginning of the semester. You have a bunch of classes that want to use those classrooms, and you have to make assignments of classes to classrooms in such a way that you can satisfy as many of the particularities of the individual classes with their assignment to classrooms. This is a very important problem, and There is a large industry that's designed to solve this problem. Another important example similar to this is crew assignments. You have, for example, offshore oil rigs, your Dutch Shell, and you have offshore oil rigs all around the world. You have to staff those oil rigs subject to constraints that are, for example, safety constraints, union constraints, national constraints, and you have to do this in such a way that you can still do the work required with the people that are there. I had a friend who at one point did work for Dutch National Shell solving these problems, and he did it all the time because, you know, labor laws change, crews change, and you constantly have to adjust it. And it's a really hard problem to deal with. And there was another one I was just thinking of, and it just fell out of my head. If you go to medical school, and when you graduate from medical school, you become an intern. It's not called an intern. What is it called? Residency. You have to have a residency in a hospital. Okay? And there are companies that will match new medical students with hospitals that are looking for residents. That is another constraint satisfaction problem, because what each resident does is it specifies, or he or she specifies, their preferred hospital in decreasing order. And what the hospitals do is specify the kind of residents they're looking for in terms of specialization or other kinds of characteristics. So you have to match doctors to hospitals. So not only are these things economically important, but if you get it wrong, you have serious consequences. The other point behind economically important algorithms, does anybody offhand know what that is? There's another usually important characteristic of economically important algorithms. They are essentially intractable, which means that they are difficult to solve. They are essentially exponential in growth, at least exponential in growth. People aren't going to pay you millions of dollars to solve these problems if they're not hard. People don't pay you millions of dollars to sort things, right? Because sorting is a trivial task. But solving these kinds of problems is hard because at base, these problems are intractable. The technical term for that is NP complete. So that's something we have to watch out for. Or at least NP hard. Let me not just say they could be NP complete. I think most of them are in various formulations, but certainly NP hard. So our first algorithm that we're going to look at for solving constraint satisfaction problems is my favorite, one of my favorite algorithms, because it's simple and it always works. And that's brute force algorithms. Now, the textbook calls it generate and test, I think. Generate and test, yes, but I like brute force. So this is our first constraint satisfaction problem. How does it work? I mean, just look at it. Right, you can either look at brute force or you can look at generate and test. How does it work? I mean, I understand you've all have already read this section, but let's pretend that you haven't. How would you expect generate and test to work? Or brute force, either one. What would be the general outline? So let me set the problem up for you. You have a possible world, which is essentially a set of variables. So you have V1 up to Vn variables, which represent n features in your possible world. Each one of those variables has a domain, and we will assume that, let's assume that domains are finite. So we have domain of V sub I is finite. And we have a set of constraints. C1 up to Cm over the variables, which specify appropriate values for assignment to the individual variables. That's the setup. Now, how do I use brute force to solve it? You can either characterize the notion of brute force solution, or you can just give me the code. And I should say that you're undoubtedly familiar with brute force algorithms from your data structures and algorithms class. Same thing. This is the same thing, except we have these extra little constraint or possible worlds here that we have to deal with. that we're actually doing the brute force over. So, what is a brute force solution to the constraint satisfaction problem? Or, if you prefer, generate and test. That's a little bit perhaps more obvious in terms of what you would do. How would you expect a generate and test solution to work? What would you expect it to do? Well, I just think about it. What are you generating? What are you testing? Well, it's not quite that easy, because how would you do that? Okay, give me more detail. I mean, how does that work? What does it mean to generate? I mean, how do I know when I have a solution? You can have problems that don't have solutions. For example, see, this is the interesting thing about your second programming assignment, as I'm sure you already understand, having looked at it. You have infinite domains. Right? So that's one of the things you're going to have to deal with in solving your problem, is how you're going to deal with those infinite domains. But if we assume finite domains for your programming assignment, there are still configurations that can't be solved. I mean, for example, if I give you a rectangle that's 1 by 1 and I give you a circle that's 2 inches in diameter, you can't solve that problem. That has no solution. And if we assume finite domains everywhere, you're still not going to solve that problem. And so the fact that the things are finite, the domains are finite, doesn't really have anything to do with the nature of the solution. It does have to do with the nature of the algorithm, though, for reasons that we'll see eventually, as soon as you figure it out, what it means. So again, generate and test. What would you expect? How would you characterize a generate and test solution to the constraint satisfaction problem? Well, what would you be generating here? Again, let's go back to that question. What would you be generating? The constraints are given. So this is your representation of the problem, the set of variables and the domain. And then the constraints are the relationship among the values assigned to the variables and the variables themselves. So these are given as the input to your problem, so to speak. Now, you have to make them up in your second programming assignment, but because I just give you an instance of the problem, and then you have to turn that into variables and constraints. But same principle. So what else can we generate? I mean, again, what are we trying to do here? What is the purpose? What is the objective of this algorithm? Why are we doing this? And if you want something concrete, well, think about one of these problems. Think about classroom assignment or crew assignment or donors to hospital, or not donors, but doctors, residents to hospitals. How would you do a generate and test for classroom assignments? What would you expect that algorithm to do for the classroom assignment problem? Okay. And then, what belongs to the same class? What is the nature of the problem in classroom assignment? Right, but what are we assigning? Classrooms, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we want to assign classrooms to classes. We have a set of rooms. Let's suppose that we have a small building. We have 4 rooms. And we have classes. Right? We have like 10, 12 classes. A through, let's see, if it's 12, I guess it would go somewhere around M. So we have classes A through M, and they have meeting times, right? They meet on Mondays and Wednesdays from 7 to 9, so on and so forth. So what is the classroom assignment problem here? What are the features, first of all? What features would be useful here? So there's timings and days, but what else? That's true, but again, what are the relations? We need to be describing relationships here. So you said dates and time, and presumably you want to break those up into 2 separate features. Okay, what else? Right, class. Well, actually, we should be a little careful. Let me say room here, not class. So we have 4 rooms, 1, 2, 3, and 4. What's the last feature you might expect? Well, that's 12. We could put that in, but let's not, because I don't see a particular use for it. Actually, there is a use for it. You'd like to make sure that all the classes get assigned to classrooms. Maybe you would put that in, but let's not, because that makes things complicated. But there is one more we need. The courses. All right, so now this may not be the appropriate set of features, but as a first cut, that seems kind of obvious. Now, what are the constraints? Yes, but, I mean, how would you specify that? Right, class free time. So again, what would be a constraint on that? How would you specify that? And I should say there's a number of different ways you could do this, right? You can define constraints in all different kinds of ways. And part of the experience that comes with these problems is figuring out what the appropriate kinds of constraints, as well as features and possible worlds, you can use to solve a particular problem. Yes, you could use intentional or extensional. I mean, we'd have to figure out what those mean, and it's just better to like specify the constraints rather than worry about whether they're intentional or extensional, which is just like things that logicians say. You might want to think about that. Let's just go back to the subject here. So we got off track because the question is, what does generate and test mean? And so essentially, the generate and test algorithm is generate all possible worlds. All right, that's the generate part. And then test each one for constraint satisfaction. If you find a possible world that satisfies the constraints, you found a solution. Congratulations. Now you can see why it's called generate and test, and you can also see why it's called brute force, because you have to generate all possible worlds. Is there an algorithm that can do this? I mean, does this make sense? Maybe it's not possible to write an algorithm to solve this problem. Right, this might be a problem like the halting problem, where you can't solve it under a certain set of assumptions. Can you think of an algorithm that would actually do this? I mean, again, you can rely on your data structure and algorithm experience to solve this problem. You have to massage it a little bit, but so think back to your data structures and algorithms. How would you actually provide an algorithm to do this? Because if we can provide an algorithm to do this, then, in fact, it can be done. We just use the algorithm. It's actually pretty straightforward. Right? We have n variables. So what you're going to have is four. Let's see, I in the domain of V sub 1. All right, so this essentially picks the values from the domain V sub 1. Let me make that small v sub 1. So this essentially assigns in sequence small v sub 1 the values in the domain V sub 1. 4 v sub 2 in the domain of V sub 2. All right, little v sub 2 in the domain of capital V sub 2. Dot, dot, dot. 4 v sub n in the domain of V sub n. So what we have done is we have assigned each one of the features in our possible world a value. And so now we have a completely specified possible world. And then we can ask the question, does V sub 1 through V sub n satisfy the constraints? C sub 1 through C sub m. If the answer is yes, congratulations, you found a solution. Otherwise, just loop around and do it again. And there you go. That's brute force. That's the other reason I like brute force. It's dead simple. And it's guaranteed to work. Well, that sounds ideal. A simple algorithm guaranteed to work? Who could ask for anything more? Why aren't we done here? Why haven't we completely solved the constraint satisfaction problem? But my question was, I mean, that's it. We're done. Right? We can go home now. We've solved constraint satisfaction completely. Or have we? Then we go on to the next. All right. We assign the next value in the for loop and check that one. Now, of course, what could happen is there could be no solution. Right? We could have a problem that doesn't have solutions, like the problem I gave you earlier with respect to your second programming assignment. And in that case, you just fall out the bottom and return a special value that says, oh, this problem can't be solved. Sorry. To answer this question as to why we haven't completely solved constraint satisfaction, you might want to draw on your data structure and algorithms experience. What is the runtime of this algorithm? This is a pretty easy one. You probably did this like in the first couple weeks of your data structures and algorithms course. What's the runtime of that algorithm? Assume that it's big O of n squared. How did you get that? You just guessed. You can do a little bit better than just guessing. I mean, guessing's a reasonable thing to do, but you should have an informed guess. So how many times does this loop go? Let's assume it goes n times, right? Let's assume that each domain has n, because, again, this is asymptotic analysis. So we can wave our hands as long as we get a upper bound on these things. So let's assume that each one of these domains, V sub I, is not only finite, but equal to N. All right, and if you want, you can make N be the largest of the domains. Oh, you also see now, all right, that's a good point. Why is this finite constraint here? What would happen if we got rid of the constraint that the domains be finite? And again, this is relevant to your second programming assignment. Because as it stands, you can't use this for your second programming assignment. Why not? Is another way to think of that question. So what happens if we get rid of the finite requirement on the domains for this solution? Well, what does it mean to have an infinite domain? How many values do you have in an infinite domain? Right, exactly. You have infinitely many values in an infinite domain, right? Makes perfectly good sense. But what does a for loop do? A for loop goes through every value in a domain. So if you have infinitely many values, and you have a for loop over that domain, what's going to happen? That for loop is never going to end. Now, that's not too bad if you have solutions, right? Because eventually you're going to find a solution. Maybe. If I have an infinite domain, does this will this work? Why not? That's true, but, well, I don't know if I want to belabor the point. Not necessarily. Because essentially what that means is the loop will never consider other values in the outer loops. All right, so if the values in the outer loops are incorrect, they will never be fixed in the inner loops, and you'll never find a solution even though a solution exists. So that's why the domains have to be finite, right? Because you would like this thing to eventually terminate, independent of whether or not solutions exist. Okay, so what was my original question? Oh, yes, the runtime here. All right, so this iterates for n. This iterates n times, okay? And let's see, it works better if we go from the outside, from the inside out. So this innermost loop iterates n times, right? For each of the iterations in the next highest loop. But how many times does that go? It goes n times. So this executes n squared times, right? So now the question is, how many times does that iterate? And it iterates n times because of the next higher loop, and so on and so forth. So essentially what happens is, the number of iterations, the total number of iterations, is essentially n. Actually, I shouldn't use m for the size of the domain, but it is, you have n variables, so you have n loops, and each loop is going to iterate for, let me say, d times, where d is the size of the domain. That's exponential. All right, so this is, again, not a practical solution to the problem. If you have problems with small domains, you know, two or three or four, and you don't have a lot of variables, this may work perfectly well. It's like your first programming assignment, right? You could solve that perfectly well with the generic search algorithm we used, even though it's wildly impractical. Problem is, you can't solve big instances. I couldn't solve an instance of size 7 in less than 20 seconds, but you can certainly solve the instance of size 5 and the instance of size 6 in less than 20 seconds. So the first programming assignment took me like 30 minutes to write because I just copied the algorithm from the book. Okay, so that's it. That is our first attempt at a solution, and it's useful for very small problem sizes. Like, for example, we might actually be able to use it to solve this little example we had here. Perhaps not. But the point is, it's not very complicated. You could code this up very quickly. That's about it. So any questions about brute force? Again, you're familiar with this from your data structures and algorithms. It has all the properties there. It has all the properties here that it had there. So it's still a useful thing to do, but not for anything of reasonable size. Certainly you can't use it to solve these kinds of real-life problems. So, alas, we have not solved the constraint satisfaction problem, and we now have to go on and consider other algorithms that might give us a better approach at solving more realistic problems. And we are going to now draw on our knowledge of what we learned in the previous section. So we are going to solve by informed search. We're going to start off by talking about uninformed search. All right, and then we're going to go on to talk about informed search. And this is essentially going to be the stuff that we had learned in the previous section. Well, the simpler ones anyway. But before we can do that, we have to think about whether or not the constraint solution problem, as we have specified it, is applicable to state-based search. Can we even use state searching to solve the constraint-based problems? Can we do this? Do we have everything we need to apply those techniques that we talked about in the previous section? Well, what do we need to use the techniques we talked about in the previous section? Again, think of your first homework assignment. What did you do there? How did you solve that problem? What did you need to have in order to solve that problem? As an example. Sorry?
You need to have a solver class for that.
You need to have a?
Solver class.
Well, just think in general terms. Don't think in programming terms, right? Because we're not going to program up a solution here. You may program this up for your second programming assignment, but just think more generally. What did you need to have to solve the problem? Exactly. You need to have moves, right? Because that was essentially how you established a relationship between the states and to get the graph, right? Because essentially what we were doing in the previous section, in one word, is graph search. That's two words, actually. One phrase is graph search. So we needed a graph. And we got the graph by thinking about states and then the relationship among the states that result from doing a move in the problem, for some characterization of move. Do we have that here? Because if we're going to use those techniques, then we're going to need to have some sort of characteristic like those techniques. And your answer is no, and that's correct. We have no relationship among the possible worlds. They're just assignments of values to variables. Right? So if we are in fact going to solve CSP by state search, then we're going to have to come up with something that allows us to relate one possible world to the next. That will give us a graph that we can form, and then we can apply the search techniques that we learned about in the previous section. So now we need to figure out what kind of relationship we can have. And we don't have a lot to work with, do we? Right? We have possible worlds, which are essentially just tuples of variables. And what do we do? What sort of corresponds to a move from that point of view? Because that's what we need, right? We need this idea of a relationship between one possible world and the next. And there isn't a lot there to play with, right? So what do we have to play with to form our graph? We're dealing with constraint satisfaction problems here. So we have possible worlds, right? So we need relationships between possible worlds. And what can we do in the constraint-based world? You can do two things. You can assign values to variables and check for constraint satisfaction. Right. Well, constraint satisfaction doesn't really transform anything. It just answers a question as to whether or not this possible world is acceptable or not. All right. So that means the only thing we have left is variable assignment. But it turns out that's enough. So we can establish a relationship between possible worlds by assigning a value to a variable that's undefined in one world to create a new world in which that variable is defined. So we can have, for example, we could have a possible world V sub 1 where V sub 1 is equal to, I don't know, 1, and V sub 2 is equal to dog, and then V sub 3 is equal to this symbol, which will mean undefined, okay, and so forth. The remaining variables up to V sub N are this undefined symbol, this upside down T. All right, so this represents a possible world. It's not a complete possible world because there are unassigned variables, okay? But we can define a relationship between this possible world, PW1, and PW2. How did I get from PW1 to PW2? What was the action or the move that took me from PW1 to PW2? What was the action? What is the difference between PW1 and PW2? Right. And how did it change? What action or move do we have in the constraint satisfaction problem that allows us to do this? Maybe I'm pulling a fast one. Maybe we can't do this in a constraint satisfaction problem. And I'm trying to trick you. So what is the action or the move that allows me to go from PW1 to PW2? Well, it might help if you draw a picture. What are we trying to do? We're trying to come up with a graph, right? So let's have PW1, and then we'll put an edge to PW2. All right, this is where we want to end up. But the question is, how do we label this edge? What do we put here to make this a legitimate graph? Yes, that's right. But what is the relationship? How did we get that? How do we get from PW1 to PW2? I mean, these are just generic variables. They could be coordinates, but with a value like yellow, probably not. Yeah. How do they go from PW1 to PW2? Exactly. So how did that happen? Is it possible for that to happen? Yes. But how did that happen? A variable assignment. Right? So the relationship between PW1 and PW2 is a variable assignment. An unassigned variable in PW1 received a value in PW2. So we assigned a value to an unassigned variable. And that's the relationship between these two possible worlds. That's enough to give us a graph. What kind of graph is it? Again, from your data structures and algorithms knowledge, I mean, in terms of just graphs, how would you characterize this graph? There's a particular kind of... It's a directed graph, but there's even more structure there. Just sort of follow through how you would build the graph. It's a tree, right? You have a node, which is essentially a set of variables. Some of those variables are defined, and others of those variables are undefined. What are its children? What's the child of the node? Right, possible worlds in which an undefined variable in the parent receives a value in the child. So those are the children. What is the leaf nodes of this tree? It's actually not a tree, it's a DAG, but we'll ignore that. What are the leaf nodes in this tree? Can PW2 be a leaf node?
Yes.
Why? It has an unassigned variable. So what are the leaf nodes here? They are essentially the possible worlds that have no unassigned variables. Because how do we get children in this tree? You take an unassigned variable and assign it a value from its domain. If the possible world has no unassigned values, variables, then you can't do any assignments. So there has no children, it is a leaf. What's the root of the tree? What's PW? How did we get the first node, though? Where did the first node come? Where did PW1 come from? What's the root of the tree? So the leaves are possible worlds with no unassigned variables. Okay, what's the root? And this is actually an important question, because if it has more than one root, it can't be a tree, right? It's some other data structure like a forest or something like that. So is this really a tree? Do we have a root for this tree? And if we do, what is it? Yes, that's right. But what is the root node? You have to tell me. I asked you that question. I said, what is the root node? You have to tell me what the answer is. Can you characterize what the root node looks like as a possible world? Yes, that's correct. But what is that node? What is it? Does it even exist? It may not exist. That's right. It may or may not exist. And that's my question. Does it exist? And if it does exist, what does it look like? Well, it does exist, and it looks like the possible world in which all variables are unassigned. So it's the possible world with no assigned variables. Which is kind of pleasing, right? The root has no assigned variables, and the leaves have all assigned variables. I mean, the textbook presents it as a tree, but technically speaking, it's not a tree, it's a DAG. And why is that? Well, I don't want to spend too much time on it. But if we start off, for example, with a two-variable... And I'm not going to write the variables in, I'll just write the values, okay? So we have a two-variable possible world, okay, V1, V2, and we can assign the value of 1 to the first unassigned, or we can assign the value of, 2 to the second unassigned. And then we can assign from this root, from this node, the value of 2. Okay, and from this node, we can assign the value of 1. Right? So that's a DAG and not a tree. But the textbook would draw that as two instances of the possible world 1-2. Right? So that's just a little aside. But you can treat it as a tree or a DAG, doesn't matter. Are we done? Have we done enough to be able to apply our techniques that we learned in the previous section? So now we have an ability to generate some sort of structure, graph structure, that we can traverse over. Do we need anything else? No, not really. We have what we need. So now, but what we do need is we need a search algorithm to apply over this structure. What do you recommend? Again, you're all experts now because you've gone through the second section, which is chapter 3, right? So you know all about state-based search. Now, show me your expertise. What would you apply to this kind of possible world tree graph? DFS. Perfectly fine. So we could do depth first search. Give me another example. What else could you apply? Give me a particular example of an unbiased search. Depth first search is kind of an unbiased search, right? Give me another example. Breadth first search. You could do that. You could use the generic search algorithm. You could do that. It'd be interesting to think about heuristics. There actually might be some heuristics here that we could use, although we'd probably have to think about that a little bit. And if we have heuristics, then you could use something like A-star search. Right? So anything you want. I mean, depth-first search works fine. So how would depth-first search work? What would be that? Well, we know how it works, but how would it work on this particular tree? What would it be doing? What would it be looking for? Well, how does depth-first... Let's see. What do I need to say? What else do I need to say here? How much time can I spend beating this one over the head? All right, we have time, so I can beat you over the head with this. So what was the question? Oh, depth-first search. What is depth-first search doing here? Well, we know what it's doing. It's going down. It's going down from the root. But I mean, how is it going to be used to solve this problem? Again, just outline it. We don't need to see the code here, but just outline the behavior of depth-first search on this kind of graph. That's true. Okay, and keep going. When does it stop? Right, exactly. So depth-first search will essentially dive down to a leaf, right? Which is essentially what you just said, right? So depth-first search will dive down to a leaf, and then what? What's the next step? It's probably going to do something before it backtracks, right? What is the objective of this search? What is this search trying to do overall? Find a solution. Can you give me a more crisper definition of what a solution is? Right, give me a more crisper definition of a goal state. What is a goal state in this particular problem? Right, but what about a possible world? What's special about the possible world? Remember where we are. We're at the leaves, right? Which means that we have no unassigned variables. A possible world that satisfies the constraints. Right, this is a constraint satisfaction problem. Dive down to a leaf, then what? What does depth-first search do at a leaf? This particular version of depth-first search do at a leaf? No, because there are no values to assign, right? That's what it means to be a leaf. Leaf is a possible world with no unassigned values. Unassigned variables. It cannot be assigned anymore because there are no more places to put values. So what do we want to do? See if the possible world satisfies the constraint. All right, so if the possible world satisfies the constraints, done. Let's assume that we're looking for the existence of a single goal state. All right, you could look for all of them, or you could just answer the question whether or not they exist, right? You can modify it appropriately. We'll just assume that we're interested in a goal state. We found it. It's a possible world that satisfies the constraints. And then we just return that possible world. Otherwise, right, we have to backtrack. Continue the search. We do that by backtracking. That's it. And then, of course, if we fall off the loop, then there's no solution, and we return some special value. So that's it. All right, that's how we can use depth-first search. And, of course, if you want to use breadth-first search or, best-first, if you can figure out some way to define best, you could use that, too. Same thing. I mean, again, the stuff that you learned in the previous section applies here. Now, you should be upset at this point. Why is that? And, in fact, we'll take care of this in the next lecture. Probably the next lecture. And then the last lecture in this section, we'll look at other techniques for solving constraint problems. But, I mean, this should be upsetting to you. Why? Well, there's a couple reasons why it should be upsetting to you. What's the first one? The first one is, what's the running time of this algorithm? The running time of this algorithm, it's no different from brute force. It's exponential. Right, so that's awful. This is not practical. Okay, but the other reason you should be upset is like, this is state-based search. We're in this section because we're supposed to be looking at new and exciting algorithms for reasoning, and we're just falling back on the old stuff, the state-based search stuff. Right? But I sort of warned you about this. I said that, you know, state-based search is a reasoning technique in its own right, but it's also the basis of a lot of the other search techniques that we'll be looking at in later sections. And this is the first time we've seen that. Okay, this is an example of pretty straightforward state-based search applied to possible world constraint satisfaction. We will take care of the second problem in the next lecture when we look at some more kind of advanced forms of state-based search. But for now, we'll take care of the first. We actually can't take care of the first problem, right? Because you cannot outrun exponential growth. All right, but there is a little trick that you can apply. Now, what are the techniques that we learned in the previous lecture for dealing with state spaces? We learned some techniques for manipulating the states, the state space graph, to make the searching a little bit more efficient. What are some of those techniques? Again, we're running out of time, so I'll just tell you. Pruning. Pruning was one of those techniques. So let's see if we can apply pruning here. Let's suppose that we reach a leaf which contains a bunch of values, v sub 1 up to v sub n. And let's suppose that this leaf does not satisfy the constraints. What does that mean? What does it mean when a leaf does not satisfy a constraint? From our definitions of constraints and constraint satisfaction, what does it mean when a value does not satisfy a constraint? That's true, but with respect to... Right, so this is not a possible world, and the reason it's not a possible world is because that value did not satisfy the constraint. At some point, from the root node down to this leaf, that value... So let's say it's v sub I. So v sub I contains a value that doesn't satisfy the constraint. Now, at some point, from the path, from the root down to the leaf node, v sub I got a value, right? Because that's how the tree is constructed. There was some parent in which v sub I had no value, and then in one of its children, v sub I had a value. Right? So at that point, v sub I, some point up here, we have a parent and a child, and the edge between the parent and the child was v sub I gets some value. And that value does not satisfy the constraint, right? Because we go down to the leaf, and this possible world does not satisfy the constraint because of what's in v sub I. Okay? Everyone got that? Because now here's the question. So what? What does that mean? What's the big deal about that? No, it's not, because we wouldn't have been able to assign that value to v sub I if it was, right? Because the point here is that v sub I is undefined in the parent and defined in the child. That's this relationship right here. So that's the point here. Again, what are we talking about? Pruning. So, put them together. What should we conclude? What you should conclude is that at this point, any possible world that is a grandchild or a descendant of this node is not going to satisfy the constraints. Why is that? We have this represents the root of a subtree, again, from your data structure knowledge. Okay, and at the bottom of the subtree are a bunch of possible worlds. What can you say about each and every one of those possible worlds? They don't satisfy the constraints. Why not? Every one of them fails to satisfy the constraints. Why not? Though they are possible worlds because they all have defined variables. Every variable they have is defined with a value. But they don't satisfy the constraints. Why not? Yes, that's true, but so what? Why does that mean that they don't satisfy the constraints? Why don't these possible worlds satisfy the constraint? Because each one of these possible worlds contains as its ith value, variable, the value that doesn't satisfy the constraint. Right? So each one of these possible worlds is going to fail, which means that we can prune this tree right here. Right? There's no need to consider any further this subtree, because every possible world that results will fail to satisfy the constraint, because the ith variable contains a value that does not satisfy the constraint. So we can modify the depth-first search to prune the tree by the values that it's assigning to the variables. If they don't satisfy the constraint, then the depth-first search can stop at that point and backtrack. Doesn't have to go all the way down to the leaves before it can backtrack. All right, so they can make the search more efficient by pruning non-satisfactory value assignments. Okay? By pruning non-satisfactory value assignments, I can essentially cut the scope of the tree that has to be traversed. Now, it's still going to be exponential in the worst case, but that at least gives you a little help. And I believe that's about all I want to say with respect to, let's see, the state space graph is huge. Yeah, we talked about that. Prune the graph at non-satisfying variable assignments. So essentially what we're doing is we're moving here the constraint checks from the leaves up into the tree, into the interior of the tree. Right? Rather than waiting until we get a leaf to check the constraints, we are checking the constraints as we do the assignments. That's all. And then if it fails, you prune at that point and backtrack from there. Or do whatever it is you do if you're not doing depth first search. Any questions about this?